This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Charles C. Mann has written about the intersection of science, technology, and commerce for many newspapers, magazines, and books. His latest book, The Wizard and the Prophet, is about two scientists and their dueling predictions about the future of our planet. The prophet of the title is a scientist named William Vogt, an ecologist and ornithologist with a strong interest in conservation and population control. And the wizard is Nobel Peace Prize winner Norman Borlaug, who is credited for saving millions of lives through wheat improvement. I caught up with Mann to talk about his book, The Two Scientists and Both Schools of Thought. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. In The Wizard and the Prophet, you introduce us to two men and to two lines of thinking. Vogt, the prophet, believed that unless humankind reduces consumption and its growing numbers, we would overwhelm the planet's ecosystems. And Borlaug, the wizard, was part of the Green Revolution. He believed that genetically engineered crops could produce more food and save the world from hunger. The debate between both camps continues to this day, and you even admit to being on one side or the other, depending on the day of the week.
I had hoped that by the end of writing this, I would come to a firm conclusion, but I failed to.
You begin the book by stepping back to consider what biology suggests about the trajectory of any species and if there's a reason to believe that biologists are wrong. Or if I can adopt Lynn Margulis's philosophy that you later wrote about in the first appendix, you're not asking the reader to necessarily believe it. You're asking us to understand why biologists believe it. Is that right?
Yeah. And her viewpoint was this. She saw me actually one day in the street. She lived in my town. She was a famous biologist, and we knew each other a little bit. And I think she thought I was a kind of a nice but sort of sentimental sap. And I was reading a book about conservation. It happened to be actually one of the books by Al Gore, and she sort of picked it up. And she didn't say anything, but she had this very eloquent silence, if you know what I mean. And I said, "Wait, hey, come on. Don't you think it would be sad if, you know, panda bears or something were to go extinct?" And she said, "Well, no, because that's the way it is. Creatures go extinct. And, you know, if we went extinct, the world would be fine. You know, in a million years, you wouldn't even be able to tell anything. It would just be the same, except we wouldn't be in it." And I said, "Well, don't you think we'd have any chance?" And she said, "Look, we're a successful species, and it's the fate of every successful species to wipe itself out. And that's what we're going to do. And that's the rules of nature." And so the beginning is sort of recounting my conversation and the evidence for this, and then to ask, well, do we have any reason to suppose that she's wrong? And she regarded this as straight from Darwin. Look, Darwin's big rule is that there's a law of evolution, and every species, no matter what, people, protozoa, panda bears, were all under its sway. And the rules apply to protozoa, they apply to panda bears, and they apply to us, and we're a successful species, and we're going to wipe ourselves out.
Maybe this would be a good time for you to explain to me the edge of the Petri dish.
Sure. This came from a demonstration at a class that she did. She taught an introductory biology class at the University of Massachusetts, and I live in Amherst, Massachusetts, where the university is, and she invited me to her class, and she showed this time-lapse video, and there were two protozoa put into a Petri dish that was full of nutrient goo, and the protozoa ate and multiplied and ate and multiplied and ate and multiplied, and pretty soon they covered the entire Petri dish. They hit the walls of the Petri dish, and then they all died. They ran out of food, and they drowned in their own waste. And she said, that's what creatures do. They just eat all the resources they possibly can. They consume all they can, and then they die. And people are no different. That was her point of view.
Now, I was really intrigued by the history of the zebra mussel invasion in the lower Hudson River.
Mm-hmm.
You know, following the boom, the population collapsed because of the blue crab. And I'm assuming that's kind of another example of how that species came to an end in that area. And I was
right. It temporarily escaped the bounds of natural selection. It just exploded like crazy. It consumed all the resources, and then it met a bad end. And her point of view is people are just the same way. We have escaped natural predators. We're expanding without bound, and pretty soon we will meet with a bad end.
You know, we have zebra mussels in our lakes around here. We do not have blue crab.
I think that from what I understand from the USDA biologists who track these things, that you guys still are in the early stages of it. And they would be very surprised if there are as many zebra mussels 20 or 30 years from now as there are today.
Okay. Well, that's good to know, except I'll probably be gone. to introduce us then to both lines of thinking of Borlaug and Vogt, you move deeper into detail about the two men. And they, the Vogt and Borlaug came from strikingly different backgrounds. Vogt grew up on Long Island, and he was really into nature and birding. In fact, he had a lot to do with the publication of Peterson's Field Guide to Birds. Is that right?
Yes, he did. He was the direct inspiration for Peterson. He met Peterson when they were both young men. He was intrigued by Peterson's methods and said he ought to write a book. Peterson, who also came from a very poor background, had no idea how to do it, and Vogt served as his encouragement, his muse, his sounding board, and his editor, and tried to get it published. He was a terrible salesman, but Peterson nonetheless succeeded, and it became a huge classic. It's actually dedicated to Vogt.
You know, on the, you know, the other extreme, Borlaug grew up in Iowa. He grew up poor, and to me, it really, you know, labeling him as the wizard, it seemed to ring true because he really owed a lot of his success to innovation. I mean, the tractor alone allowed him to first attend high school and then later in Mexico to work in the field on Sunday when a neighbor wasn't using it. So am I wrong to think that, you know, he saw innovation as a way for him to move along and move out and to help his whole progression along?
Yes. He became the sort of symbol or emblem or what have you for the idea that science and technology, properly applied, will let us produce our way out of our problems. That, okay, there's more people, there's many more appetites around, but if we just turned on the science machine, put on our thinking caps, develop the right kind of technology, we can make more. Whereas Vogt said, no, that's deluding ourselves. The world is finite. There are these ecological limits, sometimes what we call planetary bounds or carrying capacity, a bunch of different names. But the point is, there's these limits we have to stay within. And so he put together this idea and said, we need to, you know, essentially put on our cardigan sweaters, you know, turn down the thermostats, eat lower on the food chain. All the basic ideas of the modern environmental movement stem from this insight. And the two guys met once. They detested each other. Vogt, in fact, sort of half-heartedly tried to get Borlaug shut down, and then they didn't speak for the rest of their lives. Vogt would never even mention Borlaug by name, and vice versa. And these two ideas about what to do about the future have been fighting ever since. One is make more, you know, be smart and make more, and the other is look what the rules are, obey them, and conserve. And if you think about it, they're kind of opposite of each other.
They are. And, you know, in Vogt's book, Road to Survival, he railed against the use of DDT, and Borlaug was one of its early testers for DuPont.
Yes, exactly right. You know, Borlaug said, look, nature is a toolkit. You know, we can do what we want. We'd really hate these bugs that are killing our crops and mosquitoes that are giving us infection. If we find a good insecticide, we should kill them. Vogt said, no, you're, you know, disrupting these natural systems, and you'll pay for it in the end. You have to develop other means. And underneath this dispute is one view from the wizards, from Borlaug, that, you know, the world is really a toolkit for us to do with what we want. And in Vogt's eyes, no, it's a system with its own integrity and its own rules, and we have to learn what they are and fit ourselves within it. Those are two approaches that have a radically different implications for how we think about nature and how we think about the future.
Was Borlaug just really trying to feed the world? I mean, was he inspired to promote change after witnessing that the milk strike?
Yes. As I said, he came from a very poor background. He went to college in the Depression, thanks largely to the invention of the tractor, which meant that he wouldn't be needed on his very poor family farm. His parents scraped together the money to buy one, and off he went to school. And then he got to the University of Minnesota in the middle of the Depression, and he saw the milk strike there. And what he saw were people, you know, assaulting milk trucks and stealing the milk because they were so ravenously hungry. There were riots over food, and he was horrified by this. And then a few years later, he went down to Mexico on the behest of the Rockefeller Foundation, and he went to a very, very poor country. Mexico in those days was extraordinarily poor. Something like 80% of the populace didn't have enough to eat all the time. And he thought, we have to do something about this. This is a crisis. The odd thing is that Vogt was down there at the same time, saw the same misery, and he said, look, this is what happens when you overexploit the environment. We have to learn how to take care of this environment. We have to stop demanding so much of it. Borlaug came to the opposite conclusion. He looked around there and said, what's wrong here is that the people don't have the right tools to exploit the environment. We have to make them better at it. And for Vogt, this was like saying that the solution to a fire is to throw more gasoline on it. For a freelance writer like myself, it was fascinating to discover that the two men had been in the same place at the same time and come to completely opposite conclusions.
Now, in the middle section, you invite the reader to look at four great oncoming challenges from Vogt and Borlaug's perspectives. You describe the four challenges by borrowing Plato's four elements. Earth represents agriculture and food, water is drinking water, fire is our energy supply, and air is climate change. What are the concerns and the challenges for each?
Wow. Okay, well, the food is really, how are we going to have enough to eat? By 2050, the world's population is going to be on the order of 10 billion. So there's going to be 3 billion more people, more or less. And a really important part of this is not are they just going to be ordinary people, they're going to be middle-class people because the world is becoming more prosperous. So in 2050, we'll have an absolutely unprecedented situation with 10 billion people, many of whom are middle class, and all those middle class people are going to want the same things that you and I want. They're going to want, air conditioning. They're going to want nice cars. They're going to want to eat occasional treats. In fact, I jokingly called the book Toblerone for 10 billion at one point, but my editor wisely shot that. And so how are we going to supply them for this? And the great fear of the prophets, of the Vogtians, is that industrial agriculture will simply actually wreck the earth so that we won't be able to feed everybody, and what we need to do is to go to a completely different kind of agriculture. The great fear of the Borlaugians is that we won't embrace genetic modification and we won't make hyperproductive crops that will be enough to feed everybody. And so there's a big debate there. How should we go? With water, it's the same kind of thing. There is what they call a hard path and a soft path. And the hard path is, let's have giant desalination plants, maybe powered by nuclear power. Let's have huge water projects, and let's just make more water and send it around. And the prophets say, that's crazy. It totally disrupts natural ecosystems. What we need to do is stop wasting so much water. And it is quite true that we waste huge amounts of water. In places like California, where there's a drought, they actually grow cattle feed, alfalfa, huge amounts of it, and ship it over to the Middle West to feed cows. The Middle West can grow alfalfa, and the prophets see that as basically taking water out of drought-stricken California and shipping it to the Middle West, which is crazy. And so there's a big fight over there. With energy supply, the question is, can we keep, and there's been a long debate over this, can we keep sucking coal, oil, and gas out of the ground, or are there some limits? And there has been a decades-long fight about this, and the current version of it is called peak oil, and the idea that we have taken more of the oil out of it and burned it than there is left. And there's been a long fight about this, and should we be conserving and going to solar power, or should we keep using it? And with climate change, there you have a similar kind of divide. Do you, conserve, just stop using fossil fuels, or do you start doing things like having massive nuclear power plants and what they call carbon capture plants, which are big devices to suck carbon out of the air, and possibly even use geoengineering, which is trying to deliberately alter the climate of the Earth in such a way as to counteract the effects of climate change.
Now, you did separate earth, water, and fire from air.
Yes, they're different from each other in a little bit, because with earth, it's just, I stole this thing. Actually, I should immediately say I stole it from Michael Pollan, who used a similar division in one of his books, and I wrote to him and I asked if I could steal it, and he said that he had actually stolen it from his wife, which is it. So I should immediately credit Michael Pollan's wife with this idea. But basically, it's a way of categorizing things. Air is agriculture. Do we have enough to eat? Water's water, fresh water. Will we have enough to drink? And fire is energy. Will we have enough energy? And if so, how? And then climate change is kind of odd man out. That's air, because it's not something anybody wants. It's a byproduct of getting the other things.
Do you think GMOs are misunderstood?
Well, yes and no. There's an awful lot of fight about whether they're safe or not. I think, to the best of our knowledge, they are safe. But then that doesn't necessarily mean they're desirable. What the people who dislike them really dislike is giant-scale industrial agriculture. And they feel that that's environmentally destructive, and GMOs are a way to prop up, for a while, a system that they think shouldn't be propped up. And so in that way, they're not misunderstood because the advocates, of course, also see it as a way of keeping industrial agriculture going.
I was thinking about Vogt and Borlaug. You wrote that they were both melancholy toward the end of their lives. Vogt killed himself in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And Borlaug worked almost until his death in 2009. But you said that Vogt, he had wasted a couple of decades because instead of, he was mocking scientists instead of listening to them. Is that right?
He was sort of mocking social scientists. Both of them, in a certain way, believed strongly in the power of science and by which they understood, you know, chemistry, physics, and biology. Borlaug, of course, believed in microbiology and genetics and so forth. Vogt believed in ecology. And they both, in a certain way, disparaged the social sciences, economics, history, sociology. And both of them were surprised when their ideas were not greeted in the way that they expected. Vogt couldn't understand why society didn't turn around on a dime, partly because he didn't understand economics or sociology. And Borlaug had no idea that the changes that he unleashed would lead to social changes that many people would be upset about and would lead to people attacking him.
You know, as I was reading along, I kept remembering the quote in the epigraph by Robert L. Heilbronner. Is that how you would say
Heilbronner,
that?
Heilbronner, yeah.
Heilbronner. No wonder they disagreed so endlessly. They were talking about different things.
That's the idea of the entire book. I was so upset when I read that line. I thought, God, why am I writing this entire book? He just captured it in one sentence.
Was he talking about them specifically, or was he talking about something else? I was trying to find that quote.
He was talking about something else. It was another kind of disagreement where people got into a huge fight. It was in the realm of economics. And when he looked at it, he said, of course they're fighting. They're talking past each other. These two people had completely different scales on which they measured success and completely different preconceptions about what the world was like. And of course they fought because they couldn't possibly agree with each other.
In a recent essay for Powell's, you wrote, escaping the consequences of our explosive growth to climb over the walls of the Petri dish would require radical transformation of human society, but exactly such transformations have happened repeatedly in the past. You know, after reading this, I have to ask, are you still a depends-on-the-day-of-the-week disciple of one side or another?
Kind of. I'm fairly wishy-washy, and I also feel like, in a certain weird way, it's useful for me not to fully make up my mind because it allows me to see the merits of both sides. And in a book like this, I think it's more useful to the reader if I say clearly out, this is the choice you have to make, than if I make my recommendation. Because my recommendation will be based on my values, and it's just one person, and I'm not a particular expert. But I think I'm on much more solid ground if I say, this is what's going on over here, and this is what's going on over there. Really, the choice between these people is not so much a practical choice, like this is going to work or this is going to work, because it's very hard to make that choice. We're talking about the future, and it's really hard to predict the consequences of our actions. The basis of the choice is really about our values, what's important to us. What I've tried to do is say, if your values are this, you'll probably lean towards this course of action. If your values are this, you'll probably lean towards that course of action, and stems back to these two people, and here is what's likely to be the ground that you're walking on.
That was Charles C. Mann, author of The Wizard and the Prophet, Two Remarkable Scientists and Their Dueling Visions to Shape the World, which was published by Knopf. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at KMUW.org or on iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.